Today, as world leaders land in Buenos Aires for the G20, we speak to Guardian correspondents across the world about authoritarian leaders and their relationships with Donald Trump. Plus, in opinion, William Davies on why we stop trusting the elites. We'll start after this. It's been a bad year for global cooperation. Trade wars, election interference, and state-sponsored murders. As the G20 begins in Buenos Aires, the world will turn its attention to the leaders of China, Russia, and Saudi Arabia, and their relationships with Donald Trump. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in focus, Donald Trump and the rise of the G20 strongmen.
The G20 was set up to try and harmonise global governments.
Julian Borgia is The Guardian's World Affairs editor, who is in Buenos Aires for the summit.
10 years ago, this was about the world's biggest economies getting together and trying to rationalise global trade and investment. 10 years on, it's really about a cast of characters. People like Erdogan of Turkey, Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, and Mohammed bin Salman. Their base is built on a personality cult. And to a large extent, in almost every case, that cult, that personal support, is built on the idea of national strength, that this strong man projects national strength. And to do that, they must seek out conflict on the world stage. And so what was supposed to be a calm multilateral setting for resolving the world's economic problems has become this stage on which these puffed up actors, strong men, strut their stuff. So it, in a way, it has completely inverted what the G20 was supposed to do.
To what extent do you think the arrival of Donald Trump has changed the purpose and the theatre also of the G20?
Well, I think there are two ways in which he's done that. I mean, obviously, there's the man himself. He has limited understanding of the kind of things that are talked about at G20s. He has a very basic idea about bilateral relations. He doesn't like multilateral meetings. He likes kind of one-on-one sort of macho contests with other foreign leaders and has a strong preference towards strongmen. He is his view of the world that basically two strong, assertive male leaders sort things out between them, and that's how business is done. And so he kind of imposes that worldview on these meetings. And secondly, he basically doesn't believe in a lot of what the G20 is about. He doesn't believe really in multilateral trade. He doesn't believe in multilateral institutions. He doesn't believe in climate change. So for the biggest player there not to share these basic premises changes the nature of the event.
So as Donald Trump arrives in Buenos Aires for this G20, what does he want it to be about?
He wants it to be about him and his relationships with these other leaders, and in particular with Xi Jinping, with Vladimir Putin, and Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. And because there is such uncertainty and such volatility about these relationships, this is where all the focus will be. It has the potential to be the biggest G20 train wreck we've ever seen.
To understand this G20, we need to know more about Donald Trump's three key relationships with Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin, and Mohammed bin Salman. Tell me about the relationship between President Xi and Donald Trump.
Well, there's been obviously this very sort of superficial respect. We know that Donald Trump loves authoritarian leaders. He gives them a kind of respect that he doesn't really give to allies in democratic nations.
Tania Branigan is a leader writer who spent 7 years as The Guardian's China correspondent.
To begin with, there was this rather strange, obviously fairly fake bromance.
I want to thank you again. You're a very special man.
So we saw Xi Jinping lay on this very lavish banquet in the Forbidden City itself in Beijing.
It was truly memorable and impressive and something I will never forget.
Similarly, we've heard Donald Trump sort of talk about this delicious chocolate cake he served to President Xi and so forth.
I was sitting at the table. We had finished dinner. We're now having dessert. And we had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you've ever seen. And President Xi was enjoying it.
So there was this rather odd period where we could see things weren't going to go well, but on the surface, it was all terribly nice.
And what do you think the mood is going to be in this meeting?
Well, it's going to be clearly much tougher. We've seen this trade war really develop and escalate over recent months. We've heard Trump saying that he thinks it's sort of highly likely he's going to be raising the tariffs he's already imposed. They're due to go up from 10 to 25% at the start of next year.
What kind of things are being hit by tariffs?
There's an extraordinary range. I mean, I think bits for yachts, eels, I seem to recall, is on the list. There's a very long and peculiar list. But also, one of the things that are being hit are, of course, Chinese components coming in. And that's one of the reasons that tariffs, you know, are really not working so well for a lot of people in America. And then obviously on the Chinese side, we've seen them targeting some of these sort of agricultural products and things that it thinks will affect Xi's base.
And do we think that a deal could get done here? Or do we think something else is going on? Are both men trying to distract from other problems?
I don't think anybody really thinks that the issues between the two sides are going to be resolved that easily. And, you know, fundamentally, you've got one side going in looking for a deal and the other side really going in looking for a surrender. The US really wants a sort of a capitulation from China that it's not going to get. And I think you have to understand that this trade war is to a large degree performative, like so many things that Trump does. So it's as much about how it looks as it is about what the underlying issues are, really. It's played really well for him to say, here I am, acting tough, cracking heads on the world stage, etc. I get stuff done. But secondly, it's also really quite a useful sort of distraction from some of the other issues, isn't it? And particularly, we saw this very hostile speech. Somebody talked about it as being quite a sort of Cold War-ish speech from Mike Pence recently, going into a sort of pretty full-scale attack on China.
We will not be intimidated. And we will not stand down.
And accusing them, for example, of election meddling.
China is meddling in America's democracy. As President Trump said just last week, we have, in his words, found that China has been attempting to interfere in our upcoming midterm elections.
There is growing concern about Chinese political interference or sharp practice overseas, but there's nothing like the kind of activities that we know Russia has been doing. And so at a point where he has the Robert Mueller investigation hanging over him, it seems to me it's really quite effective for him to be able to say, look, the real bad guys are over here and I'm getting tough on them.
As Trump boarded Air Force One headed for Buenos Aires yesterday, he suggested that a planned meeting with Vladimir Putin would go ahead.
I probably will be meeting with President Putin. We haven't terminated that meeting. I was thinking about
But even before he'd landed in Argentina, the US president had changed his mind, tweeting from mid-air that he was postponing the meeting because of a deepening crisis in Ukraine. That's where our Moscow correspondent, Andrew Roth, is currently reporting from, so we gave him a call. Can you tell us what happened this week, Andrew?
So on Sunday this week, Russian Coast Guard ships seized three Ukrainian ships that were trying to pass through the Kerch Strait into the Sea of Azov.
What could be a major escalation of tension between Russia and Ukraine is developing right now off the coast of Crimea. The
Ukrainian And what happened was the Russian boats arrested the Ukrainian ships. 23 Ukrainian sailors were arrested, and Russia says they're going to put them on trial now for illegally crossing borders. Ukraine says that they should be treated as prisoners of war, and in general, they didn't commit anything wrong. I mean, as you can imagine, this is an incredibly large scandal because the two countries are already nearly on a war footing with one another. Ukraine is sort of marshalling or trying to marshal international support for its troops. Meanwhile, Russia is saying that they've done nothing wrong. And that's why this is, you know, a very important flashpoint in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine right now. The fact that this issue has led to Trump canceling the meeting between himself and Putin is quite surprising. I don't think anybody who works in this part of the world saw that. And you know, I don't think that Trump necessarily knew where the Sea of Azov was before this took place. So the fact that he chose to do this, it's going to be cheered in Kiev. Moscow might be unhappy about it, but overall it's surprising, and it does raise questions about, you know, what was the motivation behind it.
What do you think the motivation was?
If we take it at face value, what Trump is saying is that, you know, you can't act like this and then expect to meet with me in a context like the G20 in Buenos Aires. Perhaps there's another ulterior motive for this. The optics of a meeting with Putin are dangerous for Trump, particularly because of the way the Mueller investigation is going right now, because of accusations of interference in the US elections.
And the last time the pair met at that extraordinary press conference in Helsinki, Trump sided with Putin over his own intelligence community, and it caused a massive backlash.
I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be.
You were there. Do you think he's trying to avoid a repeat of that embarrassment?
In terms of being a journalist in that room of looking down, and there were, must have been 500 international journalists who were covering this event, I think everybody was just gobstopped by that performance.
I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today. And what he did is an incredible offer.
There were a couple of people as I was walking out who said they'd never seen things like that before. The performance and the optics that came after it were incredibly damaging in terms of how that performance was relayed. So, you know, Trump made it through that and it didn't seem to hurt him that much. He didn't, you know, he seemed ready to meet with Putin again. It's interesting what actually changed his mind in terms of this meeting at the G20 in Buenos Aires. You know, was it the sort of Ukrainian issue, or was there another reason for this decision?
The other problematic relationship is with Saudi Arabia's crown prince, who has now arrived in Argentina. Trump has said he would be willing to meet Mohammed bin Salman, but nothing has been arranged. Martin Chulov is The Guardian's Middle East correspondent. Tell me what's happened when Donald Trump has met Mohammed bin Salman before.
Well, the first meeting was memorable because of its optics. It was in Riyadh in May 2017. Donald Trump was received in a grand, opaque conference hall.
That's beautiful.
This is the war dance.
I can see that.
He was almost tapped on the shoulder with a silver sword. He was presented Saudi Arabia's highest honor. There were medals put around his neck. There were dignitaries lined up to receive him. There were animals slaughtered in his honor. And he was very much in his element. Here was Trump being received by the region as almost a heroic figure, with all of this praise and status being bestowed upon him. And that very much set the tone for a relationship that has continued in a really robust way for the last 18 months, and notwithstanding significant challenges.
So we don't know yet whether Trump will sit down with the Crown Prince at any point. What does Mohammed bin Salman want to get out of this summit?
He's very much looking to rehabilitate an image. I think he would understand that he has been diminished internationally, that the death of Jamal Khashoggi, and particularly the gruesome circumstances surrounding it, where he was dismembered inside a Saudi diplomatic mission after being lured inside to his death. That is something which the world is still trying to come to terms with, and many of MBS's allies, or those who were prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt, have walked away. Donald Trump hasn't. So a photo opportunity in Argentina with Trump warmly embracing him is something that he needs, something he would be looking for, and he would also be looking for an embrace of some sort from other global leaders.
And following the murder of Khashoggi, which has caused a huge backlash, Trump must be worried about how any contact with him will be perceived.
Trump has doubled down on his defence of MBS to the extent that he is not prepared to back the assessment of his own CIA, who concluded that MBS ordered the assassination of Khashoggi. Wasn't aware after the fact or prior, but ordered it, was complicit in it. For Trump to turn on his intel community yet again and embrace a strategic ally for real politic reasons, there is a pragmatism there that I think some would understand. But in such a crude, blatant, and in some way disrespectful manner to ignore such an atrocity and to move forward with the relationship regardless is something that Trump doesn't seem bothered by, but many in his party do.
And the controversy is about much more than the murder of a journalist. It's about the war in Yemen.
I think the two big projects that MBS had launched in the region in his name, a war on Yemen, which was ostensibly targeted at deterring Iranian influence on Saudi Arabia's eastern border, and a blockade of Qatar, with Qatar seen as a key backer of the Muslim Brotherhood, who Riyadh and the United Arab Emirates see as a subversive threat in the region. Both of those projects have stalled. In fact, both of them have gone backwards in the eyes of regional partners and in the eyes of the world. The US have been speaking very pointedly about Yemen in the last 6 weeks. Defense Secretary Mattis, Secretary of State Pompeo have said that they want this to be sorted as soon as possible. Now, this is almost taking a solution away from MBS's hands. He hasn't been capable of delivering anything. And I think there is an understanding now in parts of the global community, including among his allies, that he doesn't have the judgment or the temperament or the support to bring this war to any sort of conclusion without the significant help of friends.
The Guardian's World Affairs editor, Julian Borger, is now in Buenos Aires at this summit. Julian, we've heard about escalating trade wars, the conflict in Ukraine, the controversy surrounding Saudi Arabia, and about Trump's focus on these big bilateral relationships. But what about global cooperation? Do European countries, France, Germany, the UK, matter at the G20 anymore?
Yes, very much, because they are really the remaining upholders of what we came to see as the liberal order concerning democracies and trade, the world we've become accustomed to living in, you know, since the Second World War. And so the big question for the survival of that order is how far these European leaders will go to try and either stick with the US or how openly they will try to distance themselves from Trump. But underlying that is the question of how far Europe is going to take up the mantle of Western leadership from the US.
Because without that multilateral cooperation, surely a major concern is how we tackle some of the biggest global crises like climate change.
This is perhaps, in terms of the consequences, the most serious issue and the most worrying issue. At the very moment where we are being told this is the last chance saloon in terms of turning back the momentum towards catastrophic climate change, we have a leadership that doesn't even believe it's a problem. That's seriously worrying.
Do you have any optimism that this G20 or similar summits in the future can deal with issues on that scale now?
It's hard to see an alternative. These major economies and their governments have to get together and try and hammer something out. But it is particularly challenging with this particular group of authoritarian leaders who don't see their political power lying in this kind of multilateral action. They see it as projecting unilateral power into the world and worry about the perceptions of that at home. That is not conducive to agreements on the major issues facing the world.
Julian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, what's driving the backlash against the so-called establishment? Now, the political economist and author William Davies on the scandals that have demolished the credibility of establishment figures.
In Britain, I mean, it's now 10 years since the depths of the banking crisis. And then we had the Brexit referendum in 2016. And these are the sort of two major events that many people see as having shaped this very disruptive, turbulent political moment that we're now in. But we often forget of various things that happened between those two events that in some ways may actually add up to something that is more important in terms of the discrediting of mainstream political and public elites. There's a whole series of scandals that happened from 2009 onwards. And the first of those, which is arguably the most important, was the MP's expenses scandal, which blew up in May 2009. That, as an event, had a huge impact on public perceptions of Westminster and of representative democracy. It concerned a very simple matter of honesty and dishonesty that nearly anyone can grasp. But then you had the various reports from Iraq and Afghanistan that were released en masse due to the leak by Chelsea Manning to WikiLeaks. You then had the hacking scandal, the phone hacking scandal that blew up in 2011. This then followed with various other scandals, the LIBOR scandal. Then you have things like the VW emissions scandal a couple of years after that. And all of these things, I think, what they all amount to is a sense that insiders, for self-interest, whether that be for money or just simply to kind of save their skins, use the power they have in order to cover things up, and that they know things that they don't want to get out into public, and that they use their power to stop the public knowing things that the public really ought to know. For those who are looking for evidence that they're being lied to and that elites are untrustworthy, there has actually been quite a lot over the last 10 years. One thing that I think has changed quite significantly and has really shaped the politics of all of this is the spread of digital technology throughout all organisations and public life. The quantity of evidence that emerges, and can often emerge very quickly, is that much greater. So you suddenly have a dump of thousands, or in the case of the war logs, I think even millions of documents suddenly gets released. But there's a sense that the curtain has been suddenly pulled back and you see the reality that previously was being concealed by a bunch of figures who actually were telling you something else altogether. I feel pretty pessimistic right now, to be quite honest. I mean, I don't see what the forces that are out there that will reverse some of this trend towards greater suspicion of public appearances. Now, some suspicion is good, but I think what we've got at the moment is that people are developing their own narratives about what is going on below the surface in certain ways. And I think that people are cynical about what is presented to them via the mainstream media. There has to be some kind of commitment to renewal on the part of political institutions, democratic institutions, so that they can continue to seem like they are the basis of a shared reality rather than some kind of scam that is pulling the wool over people's eyes.
You can read William Davies' feature at theguardian.com and do follow all the coverage of the G20 throughout the weekend. My thanks to today's many contributors from across The Guardian, Julian Borgia, Tania Branigan, Andrew Roth, Martin Chulove and William Davies. Today's episode was produced by Josh Kelly, Lizzie Casson and Mithili Rao. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executives were Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. See you on Monday.